Dewey's here at Groundswell this year, the 26th and 27th of June, close to London, UK. Many friends of the podcast will be there. John Kempf, Abby Rose, Benedict Boezel, Henry Dimbleby, Claire Hill, Russ Carrington, Andy Cato, Tim Coates, and many, many more. See you there. This episode is about landscape approach and why operating at a landscape scale is crucial when regenerating soils, forests, and seas, and actually makes raising capital easier. If you are an investor and you are considering making investments in land use, you need to look at the full landscape you're gonna operate in. Welcome to another episode of Investing in Regenerative Agriculture, Investing as if the planet mattered, a podcast show where I talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why am I focused on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land, grow our food, and what we eat. And it's time that we, as investors, big and small, and consumers, start paying much more attention to the dirt / soil underneath our feet. Before we get started, I've been recording these interviews next to my day job, and I will definitely continue to do so and release about an episode a month. But at the same time, I would love to take this further, share more interviews. There are many more stories to share on investing in regenerative food and agriculture. More depth, improve the quality, maybe even doing some video series. So I started a Patreon community, which makes it easy to support creators like myself. If these podcasts have been of value to you, and if you have the means, I invite you to support me and make this happen. For more information, please find the link to my Patreon account in the description below. And now, without further ado, the interview. Enjoy! Welcome to a new episode. I'm Koen Vasseyen, your host, and today I interview Paul Chatterton, founder of the Landscape Finance Lab, an experimental unit inside the World Wildlife Fund. They incubate sustainable landscapes and structure, launch, and fund deals at landscape scale. I have a lot of questions because I think landscape scale is one of the most interesting pieces of regenerative agriculture and food. So welcome, Paul.
Thanks very much, Koen. It's a pleasure.
Let's dive straight in with a personal question. What brings you to WWF? What brings you to Landscape Finance Lab? And what brings you to, let's say, land use and landscape scale? Because there are not too many people actually looking at that.
It actually started sitting up a eucalypt tree in Tasmania in front of the bulldozers many, many years ago. I used to work
for the... I didn't know that. I couldn't have imagined a better start of the podcast. Go on.
Oh, man, this tree was in a forest of the tallest flowering plants on the planet, the eucalyptus regnans. The mountain ash grow to 90 meters. My tree was 80 meters tall. I was sitting in the first branch, which was 30 meters above the ground, and I sat there for a week to try to stop the bulldozers. And we saved the forest. They cut that tree down immediately. They got us out of the sky. But what it taught me was that... although we won that battle, we lost the war because for the next 15 years, we were fighting, the conservationists versus the foresters, the politicians were playing us off against each other. And it made me realize that we needed to change the game and think in a bigger picture, think in a more embracing way, and find solutions that work for all of the people in a landscape and for nature as well. And that was a long journey that took me then to New Guinea, where I ran WWF's conservation program, and then to Austria, and where I'm based now.
And just for whoever doesn't know the Landscape Finance Lab yet, what is it? What was the idea behind it? You're relatively new. You're an experimental unit, so that shows you're a pilot. But what was the reason to found it, and why a finance lab?
Yeah, the Landscape Finance Lab was set up 3 years ago. In WWF, we've been successful at winning many battles, but that war is absolutely being lost. There are half as many animals on this planet now in the wild as there were when I was born 50 years ago. It's a disaster. And the tools we have at the moment are not up to the challenge. We need to change the whole way that we're working if we're going to save nature. And we need to shift whole economies to being green. and supporting sustainability. So, you know, the lab was developed out of some of the lessons we'd learned with some of the big climate programs that we were developing to save rainforests. So we were dealing with some very large finance. These were the largest projects WWF had ever run in one place. And we were able to secure $170 million for an area in the Democratic Republic of Congo, just north of Kinshasa, to save an area of forest the size of Greece. What that taught us was that you can work with multiple players in a landscape. You can work with very, very big finance. And as you work together, it became clear that you create synergies between the different players, between the foresters that we've been fighting and ourselves, between the agriculturalists and the foresters and so forth. So very much going back to that, you know, that realization in Tasmania. But what we didn't realize at the time was the power of private sector finance to shift economies towards sustainability. And that was very much a focus of the lab. How do we do programs to save nature and promote green economy at the scale of 1 million hectares, $100 million investment, dealing with a million tons of traded goods, 1 million people. We've got to be able to operate at that scale as a nature conservation organization if we're going to save nature. But the planet needs that as well if we're going to reach the SDGs, the global goals.
And just to, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but to look at Congo in a sense and to look at this monumental shift or paradigm shift that happened in your team and the team of WWF, because I think this was one of the first times you were actually not fighting the battle. Like you were actually getting most or maybe even all stakeholders involved and figuring out a way, a puzzle basically to make everyone better instead of just blocking and basically going against the foresters that you mentioned before that you kept losing. How did you get everyone involved and is that something of a landscape that if you think at that scale, you can actually figure out a way that it's a win-win for everyone?
Well, that's actually the real beauty of the landscape approach. You know, when you're dealing with small issues, you know, a logging operation or a farm and sustainability issues, then over a short time frame in a small space, you end up with conflict. You've got very little room to move between the players. With a landscape program, you can all take a breath because you can think about landscape. You have to think about landscapes over at least a 10-year period, ideally a generation or more. You've got to think about them over a much larger space, which then gives you all the ability to be more creative, to move operations over time rather than immediately, to restore forests or water flows or whatever. This is absolutely the power of the landscape approach, that it gives everyone space to think and dream and find their own place over time. You don't have to do it all at once.
And do you have an example of that in this case? Because I'm struggling to see how a forester that just to put make it a character, basically wants to cut down as fast as possible and sell. How do you get a company like that on board on a regeneration, not even sustainability, but actually how did you get them on a regenerative way of thinking? How do you do that? And how does a landscape approach make that possible?
Well, let's go back to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The province of Mayendombe is north of Kinshasa. There's about 10 logging concessions in that area that cover an area of about 1 million hectares. These are the forests where you find the bonobo chimp, the closest animal to human beings. We as an organization have been fighting with those logging operations for a long time. They've been very destructively managed. They haven't had much money to do things properly. What happened when we started working on the landscape approach was that we were able to offer, with the World Bank, carbon funds for changing behavior in forest management. And as soon as the companies realized that was available, they started talking to us. And the more we talked, they admitted that their concessions weren't profitable at the moment. They were hanging on to them in the hope that timber prices might go up. But they were very happy to shift their business model, some of them to sell out completely, others to shift over to more sustainable operations, knowing that there'd be a new income stream that would help them to make that shift. And so, you know, rather than fighting on a concession by concession basis with each other, we were all looking at a much bigger picture. And then it created opportunities for those companies to also be helping in planting plantations away from the native forest that could supply the needs of Kinshasa, working with communities to allow forests to regenerate, and taking some of that for charcoal production in a sustainable way instead of cutting down the old growth rainforests. It's really, really changing the game. It's early days still, but already we're seeing the forest coming back, the water flows improving, women have to walk less distance in the trial villages at least, and we hope to expand that to 1,000 villages.
And is that something that gives you hope in a sense? Like, because I see that in soil often, I think the standard approach was, or the standard way of thinking, it takes 10,000 years to build an inch of topsoil, something like that. It takes a long time. And now we're actually seeing that some farmers do it way, way faster. Is that something you see in forestry, et cetera, as well? Like, it does bounce back if you give it space and structure, and you maybe even help, or you maybe replant certain things. Do we have a chance? Like, does it come back fast enough?
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you've got core rainforest seed bank, you can grow rainforest back. Not all of it, not everywhere, but in many places, certainly. And what's really exciting is that, you know, animals come back really rapidly as well if you take the pressure off. You know, my friends in Gabon had turned a very large area which had no elephants into a place that was full of elephants in 10 years.
Is that a place where they're surfing, the elephants?
Sorry?
I don't know if I'm just making it up, an article of surfing elephants, of surfing hippos maybe, in Gabon, I think.
This does include a beach area, so it could well be.
Maybe there were hippos. I will find it and put it in the show notes below. I think it was a Time article a long time ago.
Yeah, my friend was actually telling me about the elephants that appeared on his house, which is right on the beach, so could be the same one.
Very interesting. And so, taking this experience of the Democratic Republic of Congo, you founded this lab, which by the name is an experimental area, and you started working with other landscapes. How did that process go? How do you choose them? Because you're a small team based in Vienna, and there's only so much you can do, obviously. So what's the process now, after a few years of trying and trials, to work with other landscapes than Congo?
So the important principle is that, you know, the landscapes have to build themselves. The people in the landscapes have to already be very organized and ready to go on to the next stage. So we have an online platform. People fill out details, just some basic details about where they're up to. They need to show that they've got the scale. They've got a...
And people in this case are local NGOs. What kind of groups do you see approaching you?
So we started with WWF offices in places like Fiji, Cambodia, Cameroon, and so forth. And now we're getting provincial governments. The government of Yucatan has applied, investment companies, national governments, companies are starting to put ideas forward. Anyone can kick off a landscape program. The fundamental principle, though, is that they then have to form a multi-stakeholder partnership, a group of people who want to solve a problem in that landscape. They go through a process of understanding the landscape better and the problem and each other, and then they develop a collaborative plan to address the problem. It's quite simple. And then we help them with that and with getting the financing for the individual activities to address the problem. And that might be grant financing, it might be carbon financing, or more recently, we're starting to show the ability to bring in private financing into areas.
And continue on that thought, do you have an example of private finance, or one of the landscapes that's mostly advanced in this process, of where the smart impact investors that are listening to this show could get an idea of what's possible?
Yeah, well, I've just come off a call. We're right in the middle of developing an investment fund in Fiji for businesses that can help contribute to saving Fiji's reef system. Fiji has this fabulous reef system that actually contributes half of the economy from fishing and tourism. And that's going to disappear under climate change because of all of the stresses, the pollution that comes down off the land. So we want to work with...
So just to summarize, basically Fiji is killing its own reef, not only because of we're all polluting way too much and the temperature in the ocean and acidity is going up, but also because of the runoffs of their farms on the islands, right?
Exactly, from the farms, from the...
So there's a direct connection. It's not only... I mean, it's obviously also our fault, but it's not... It's part of the issue is the local pressure of the runoffs of farms that actually basically bleaches the reefs.
Exactly. You know, all the nutrients, the pesticides and fertilizers poison the reefs, the silt from the housing developments, the poo from the tourists. The tourists come... destroying what they come to see, in fact. So how do we shift that around? We helped, you know, 15 organizations, so four government departments, a number of NGOs, industry groups, banks, to put together a $115 million call for saving the reefs of Fiji, and that involved it shifting over to organic agriculture, shifting to sustainable fisheries, and restoring the mangrove forest and the river forests and dealing with waste management. And we're now developing a $30 million public sector funding program with the Fijian government. The workshops were just happening last week, in fact. But parallel to that, there's a whole lot of businesses that can actually benefit very nicely from this sort of transition. Organic agriculture is already getting a good impact investment, and we want to scale that up. Carbon money for the forest restoration and impact investment for the fishery. We're setting up a company. Well, it's a local entrepreneur is leading it at the moment. The company's called Matanataki, which is the Fijian word for action, the next step on from Talanoa. And that'll manage investments from around the world into projects that contribute to the goals of saving the reef and also monitor the impacts. We've got a couple of projects already that are lined up. We're talking to an investor in London just yesterday who's ready to move on this, and we'll be looking for other investors to join in.
It's extremely interesting, first of all, but also the first time I hear organic, and I hope this will be the regenerative organic type and not the plowing version of organic, because we've seen that way too often, unfortunately. But it's the first time I hear organic and regenerative agriculture connecting to the reef. But because that connection is so clear and so direct, I think the case in this case for transition finance to help as many farms and farmers to actually switch, to make that transition and to start supplying, hopefully, to the local tourists. So to actually get that circle and to the local hotels, etc. I mean, it's crazy that Fiji has to import a lot of its food, especially serving the tourists and then actually destroying the reef in the process.
Oh, it's insane. And again, this is the beauty of the landscape approach. You wouldn't think that farmers would be the solution to saving the reefs, but that's how it came out when everyone sat down.
Oh, I always think that farmers are the solution, like, to any problem.
So then farmers are the solution for everything, of course.
Soil and farmers. I mean, but yeah, no, I get your point.
Yeah.
And so that's, I mean, it's a small island system, sorry, but that's a huge amount of, still there, 115 and a 30 million fund. This gives you also an understanding of the scale you're thinking and working and operating. That we absolutely need, but that I often miss in much smaller programs, a few hectares here, a few hundred hectares, etc., which really is just not going to get us to scale in time, because we're literally running out of time and running out of topsoil. What do you see? I mean, you've been a few years in the program now. You've been, what has, if we look 1 year ago, it's now May 2019. If we look 1 or 1.5 year ago till now, what do you see as the biggest shift that has happened in the full sector that you're operating in?
Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
Well, for us, it's been understanding how businesses work and what bankers need to invest in good businesses. The last year has been a really dramatic learning curve for us, listening to bankers, shadowing them, understanding what they would invest in and wouldn't, and then working with the businesses to see from their side whether that sort of thing makes sense and whether they can deliver impact.
Do you have an example of that, like something that already came out?
Yeah, I mean, in Cambodia, we're working with H&M, the world's second largest garment company, who it turns out that the garment company in Cambodia is a major driver of forest destruction. They use wood to fuel the boilers that produce the steam for pressing the clothes and dyeing the cloth and so forth.
Another example of something you would never have seen if you didn't look at a landscape.
No.
Size.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, most of this happens in Phnom Penh, but the impact is out in places like the Eastern Plains, which is the largest rainforest left in Indochina. So we're connecting these two and thinking about how do you actually shift the factories over to purchasing wood from known plantations, not from the forest, and then eventually shift out of wood to solar. That's not possible at the moment, so wood is the main option. And agricultural waste briquettes are being experimented with as well. But this, you know, this came down to a very practical set of questions. Can the factory get wood at a price basically the same as what they're paying now, but legal and sustainable? And then who's going to supply that? There are a couple of plantation companies we're talking with whose operations are reasonably good. We want to be sure that that they are absolutely above board environmentally, and that they're progressing towards certification. They're not there yet, but there's not much in Cambodia that is. But if we look at it over a 10-year period, and if we've got the whole garment industry in Cambodia coming online to commit to shifting their sourcing, then you can really give some great opportunities to some of these plantation businesses. And that gives opportunities to bankers to be able to help them with the money to expand their operations and really make the change rapidly. So, you know, we're really seeing now that the finance is a tremendous driver, and also the global purchasing systems, the big companies who are driving those economies can be a real help if they're committed to sustainability as well.
Is there something else that you've seen change over the last year, that these large companies are getting involved in the landscapes, not just in their supply webs or supply chains that they have been doing, especially the forward-looking ones, but actually getting to a landscape thinking? Is it something you've seen happening, or obviously you would like it more, but is that a shift from, let's say, 5 years ago when you started looking in landscapes more and more?
Yeah, I think a lot of them have very strong goals for sustainability, and they know that their consumers want rainforest-free and cruelty-free and so forth products. The big challenge for a big company is how do you actually make that work? And it's got to work at some scale for it to be interesting for them. They're not, you know, small pet projects are not going to do it. With the cocoa industry, we're working with them in West Africa, in Cameroon, and they've got a challenge that in the next 10 years, the cocoa production will drop 40% because of climate change. The forests and the agricultural areas are drying up. So they've got to find solutions, and it's got to be at a large scale, a large enough scale to deal with the microclimates in those areas of West Africa. And that's about saving.
What do you mean by that? Like, you need to be large enough to influence the local microclimates.
So the water flow is very much dictated by forest cover. If you have forest, you have water. If you lose your forest, the water disappears in West Africa.
But this suggests that it could come back if you plant the forest, replant the forest.
It can. That's the theory. We've got to test it. But, you know, West Africa, so Ghana, Ivory Coast and Cameroon produce 60% of the world's cocoa beans. They're drying up rapidly and their ability to produce is really diminishing. Ivory Coast and Ghana don't have much forest left. They've chopped it down, so they're in a difficult position. Cameroon still has very large areas of forest, and the cocoa industry wants to make sure that it's deforestation-free. It doesn't want to be blamed for chopping down rainforests. But more importantly, their business model depends on being able to secure that water flow, and that's about being part of a much bigger initiative to protect the Congo jungles in that area. So we've just kicked that off, but we're looking at securing quite large areas of forest and helping the cocoa industry to be agents of reforestation with the farmers that they purchase from. That's a long-term initiative. It'll take a lot of research, but already we're confident that we've got the commitment from the industry to move that forward.
And because I'm making an assumption here that most of the private investors, or most of the private wealth actually is in, let's say, Europe, the North America, is it difficult because most of the projects you mentioned are very far away? So two questions. One, are you working on projects closer to these investors? And if not, or actually also yes, how do you get investors from far, literally, culturally, distance, etc.? How do you get them involved, or has it been difficult or tricky to get interest from the private investor world that maybe are not the World Bank, etc.?
We're just starting. We're learning day by day. It's really, really quite exciting. But I think one of the key lessons we learned is that our best friends are the local banks and local financial institutions, the Fiji Development Bank, the Fiji Reserve Bank, ANZ Bank in Fiji. They have been very, very useful and supportive players. We didn't realize how excited they'd get by this and how valuable it would be for them as well. In Cambodia, it's Aclita Bank, the largest bank and probably the greenest bank in Cambodia that's become interested in being a partner in this process. And that makes it much easier for investors on the other side of the world to know that there's some local institutions that can provide some rigor to the investments and some checks and balances.
And some boots on the ground and some understanding of local culture and ways of doing business. Yeah, of course.
Exactly. And, in the long run, these things have to be sustainable, have to be managed locally, even right from the first day. That's our principle is landscapes first. The team on the ground leads it. We provide some support and coaching, but they make the decisions, and our goal is to help them to get the resources to build this slowly and steadily until they've got $100 million between them to really shift the needle, to change what's happening in their landscapes. And I think that's a big shift, because most of the world is run from New York and Geneva and Frankfurt. The money goes out. It's brought out by people from those countries who do work with locals, and then the profit and control goes back. If we can put the finance and the control in the hands of the people in the landscape, they've got an incentive to look after their own home much more than the people on the other side of the world do. And, how that plays out, I'm not clear. We're just at the early days of it, of building this, but I think it is possible to have significant financing at scale in landscapes like Fiji or Cameroon that's run fully by local organizations.
And run fully probably also means part of it has to be raised locally. I mean, a local bank obviously is mostly local savers, etc. But at some point, if you get to 100 million, if you want to get to 100 million, maybe the local bank isn't enough. But it always, I mean, I completely agree. I think it has to be a hybrid between definitely some, if necessary, only if, some money from outside to get there faster. But the more you can find locally, the more sense it makes. And also the more democratization of impact investing happens, because otherwise it's always going to be a few families or a few institutions in the cities you just mentioned, which at the end of the day will be fine anyway. I mean, if we cut down the whole rainforest in Cambodia, they won't notice, but local people will. So it's that, how do you bridge that gap between where the money is and where the money is necessary without getting into the same power struggles we've been for a long time?
Exactly, and that'll be a big test. In Fiji, for instance, the government has a pretty limited budget, and you know, there's a lot of aid money flowing. They don't tend to put their money into aid projects because they last a few years, they disappear, and then another aid project comes. It might help, it may not. But if they can see that there's something that they'll be owning over time, I think there's more chance that they'll put their own money in. That's going to be a big test of our work in Fiji, and I think, you know, we'll determine the scale that we can get to. But let's see.
But also, I think on the structure side as well, because if it's locally structured on local conditions and you are able to get in outside investors, at least they don't have the advantage of dictating the deal or dictating the structures or dictating the fund. The money only comes if we do this, this, and this. No, the structure and the conditions have been set locally. And if you want to invest, great. If you don't, we'll find it somewhere else. This is, of course, an ideal scenario, and I'm not saying that this ever happens, but it does shift the game. Like, look, you're investing in something locally, and you like it or not, there's no, it's not that you can come in and set these deals or these conditions in Fiji.
And I think the Fijians don't want to control everything. They want to be partners with their investors, but they want the flexibility to do things in a Fijian way that's going to build over time and be stable. And that's what, you know, any good investor would want as well, I would think.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, because there's only so much you can do from a long distance.
Yeah.
It's also, it's a huge risk mitigation, obviously, if there's a very strong landscape partnership with very strong local partners. I think as an investor, you should be very wary if you're investing somewhere long-term in something land use related. And if there's not a landscape approach, I think there should be a few red flags going up in your due diligence.
Well, the advantage of a landscape approach we're finding is that it gives you all of the stakeholders you'd want to talk to if you're a business. You don't have to do that work yourself. It gives you a set of very clear and simple SDG targets that you can work towards and monitoring systems to measure those, so you don't have to do that yourself. It helps with the regulatory questions that you have as a business in doing fish farming or growing ginger and turmeric or whatever it might be that you're growing. And it gives you a bigger goal that you can contribute to, which makes your life more exciting as well. What we're finding with Fiji too is that the landscape, by taking the landscape approach, we can bring in multiple quite different streams of finance. You know, there's this $30 million public financing from the Green Climate Fund that we're hoping to bring. There's an impact investor that linked to a major bank that's talking about bringing an amount of money in. There's another family office that'll bring another set of money and that can be used for different types of activities. We can do crowdfunding for the early incubation process for startups. And we've actually got an insurance company very interested in looking at a different type of insurance product that rewards climate-friendly businesses and so forth. So we're actually able to bring in quite a few different types of finance, and some of them may not happen, but some will. But that, again, creates synergies and makes the whole system more stable is my theory. This is all theory, of course. You know, we've not achieved any of this in practice, so I'm talking through my hat, really. But the progress is quite exciting at the moment.
And just to get off that cloud of theory, what are the biggest barriers you see to make the landscape approach and the regeneration of landscapes? Because I think we really have to move beyond sustainability, because it keeps it as it is, which isn't good enough. What are the biggest barriers you see to make it, to make this more economically viable, for more investors to see this as a crucial piece in their, let's say, investment strategy?
Well, I think just understanding the landscape approach. We wrote a book a few years ago, the Little Sustainable Landscape book, to bring a whole lot of organizations together under one single explanation of the landscape approach. But, we need to get that message out again and again, make it really simple. There's five basic steps to build a landscape program. Make sure that people understand that and that investors understand that. The other block, I guess, is that...
What are the five steps?
So the five steps are a multi-stakeholder platform, common understanding of the issues in the landscape and possible solutions, an agreed action plan to address those solutions, getting on and implementing it, and then monitoring and learning.
Yeah, I can see investors saying, yeah, that's very complicated. It takes a lot of time. But I think that's why it's interesting that you can basically, I wouldn't say piggyback, but partner with groups like yourself, where it's already happening in the landscape and you don't have to do it completely from scratch as an investor, because that's also not really your role. Partly it is, obviously, but partly it isn't. So you need partners in this. But I can see many say, yeah, that's too complicated. It takes too long. I'll just make a direct investment somewhere and won't bother too much with it.
No, exactly. And I think that's the challenge, is to make this standard practice so that investors don't have to think about it. It just, landscape programs give them the framework to be clear on what they should be investing in and whether their investments are really making an impact. And those impacts can then be rolled up into the national reporting and global reporting on the global goals. So building that landscape program approach is part of our challenge. But then getting investment into the individual activities is the next one, and working out simple ways to do that so that investors don't have to do all of the hard work of understanding a landscape program. It just becomes, yes or no. Do I want to be in a landscape program or don't I? And here's the benefits and here's the costs and here it is not. We're starting to get that story clear, but there's still a bit of work to do.
And just to take a landscape overview for a second, to go to a slightly higher level. Mm-hmm. I've seen an interview somewhere with you where you mentioned there are 1,000 landscapes, of which 100 are critical. Is that number still up to date? Because 1,000 seems a lot and very little at the same time, and 100 seems very manageable. But I don't know if I'm completely underestimating this challenge.
Yeah, well, one day when I've got time, I'll write a scientific paper on this. But, back of the envelope, look at it, says that there are about 1,000 landscapes, ecoregions on the planet, ecological types. So to be precise, I think there's 780 odd. And there's about 1,000 river basins. There's about, if you count it up, there's about 1,000 small countries and provinces of large countries. So whichever way you cut it, there's about 1,000 landscapes on the planet. But when you look at the SDGs, the global goals, if you want to address carbon emissions, they come from about 100 landscapes. In terms of forest emissions, there's only 13 landscapes that deliver most of the forest emissions. Agricultural Wow. emissions is probably about 50. Most of the water, fresh water supply on this planet is in about 100 landscapes. The biodiversity is absolutely concentrated into probably about 50 of those landscapes. It's broadly spread, but if you save 50, you save the majority of the life on this planet, particularly the rainforests and the reefs. And then poverty is concentrated in perhaps 100 landscapes, and it often overlaps with where the emissions come from and where the biodiversity is. So our theory is that if you can save and sustainably manage 100 landscapes, if you can get them to the point where they meet the SDG goals, then you meet the SDGs on the planet. And our costings at the moment for building a landscape program and getting investment is somewhere between $100 million and $1 billion per landscape. So that's more expensive than a fighter jet, but cheaper than an aircraft carrier. And there's no reason why the world couldn't find that money. We have to now build the machinery to actually deliver on that vision, and that's what we're doing with the Landscape Finance Lab and our many partners.
It makes it extremely doable, scary, and complex at the same time, but it at least gives you a sense that it is possible, because you have been working also, for instance, with climate bonds or with the large financial institutions that are mostly debt-based, to connect at some point with them and get the real big money flowing into these systems, right?
Yeah, so green bonds, the green bond universe this year will be $250 billion worth of investment into green bonds. So this is money that is connected to climate benefits, to sustainability benefits. It's exactly the sort of money we want to get into the landscapes. So the next question is just simply, how do you build landscape bonds? Where we've just had some
conversations. You say simply, but that's not very simple. Yeah.
Maybe not so easy.
Because if I do a green bond very specifically focused on large solar parks or more electric trains, if I'm still driving some diesel, or electric cars, I've seen many of them, and they're very, very singular and linear. And if there's one thing that a landscape isn't, it's not that. So how would you, I mean, we're still in the early phases, but I'm very curious about this transition finance, especially the large chunks of money. How would you envision this process to unfold over the next couple of years?
Well, if you'd asked someone about wind farms and energy parks 10, 20 years ago, they would have said it was horribly complex and we've got little projects here and we don't know how to do it.
That's true.
Now it's just completely obvious. And that's where we are right now with land use. And landscapes are one tool to get to scale. And we, with the lab, we have a systematic process to just step people through easily all of these complex stages. And we're confident that we can get people to a point where their landscape will have a strong plan and financing to deliver on the SDGs. Now, how do we make that just standard practice in the industry? That's another thing altogether. But I took great heart when I learned the story of George Stephenson and the development of the railways, back in the 1840s. He was in exactly the same problem. In the 1840s, he had a railway, they had rails, they knew that they could build something. But what they did was quite extraordinary, was create the railway company, which brought together the politicians, the financiers, and the engineers. And within 10 years, they'd raised the equivalent of the GDP of England. They'd built 10,000 kilometres worth of railways. In 10 years, they'd invented how to build tunnels and bridges. Brunel's bridges are part of that. So it is possible, but it does take a lot of thought to take these complicated pieces and put them into a simple machine. And that's there's many people around the world working on that challenge right at the moment and linking it up to the financing. It's really, really quite exciting times.
It's extremely exciting, and I want to be conscious of your time because you have landscapes to manage, to help manage. I want to end with a final question. If you could wave your magic wand and tomorrow morning wake up, I mean, it's early morning now, but you will wake up and you have changed one thing in the regenerative land use space, what would it be?
Wow, that's a tough one, Kurt. It would be that we would all focus on just 3, 4, maybe 5 things that we're trying to achieve on this planet. The world has come together around climate emissions, so carbon, measuring carbon is pretty clear now, and the financial world has now taken that on and are doing it. But can we do the same for biodiversity? Can we do the same for sustainable, ecological, regenerative agriculture and other production types, other just simple ways that we can measure these things, attach those measurements to the finance world, and make sure that that you only get money, or you get money much cheaper if you're meeting those goals. That'll shift things really rapidly. And it's happening right at the moment. The EU is creating a thing called the Sustainable Finance Taxonomy, which is the worst possible term. It sounds really boring, but it's...
I know, but they're trying to get Regen Ag in it as well.
Exactly.
So Capital is working on it and some other friends.
Exactly. And if they can get the right measures to say, this is good Regen Ag or forestry or fisheries or whatever, and this is not, it helps the bankers can then tick yes to a certain type of investment and no to the rest. And the economies of the world will shift quite rapidly to sustainability, or at least a lot faster than they are at the moment. That's an exciting process. The Chinese are following it. The Californians are going to implement it. And if they do, the Americans will. And then the rest of the world will follow. But it's at a crucial point at the moment. I hope tomorrow I'll wake up and they've come up with the perfect answer, and we can all just put that into practice in our many systems.
I want to thank you so much, Paul, for this answer, but actually the whole interview so far, which I think has been extremely interesting to hopefully get more people to look at a landscape approach and to consider that when approaching investments in land use. I'll definitely be checking in, and thanks again for your time and wisdom.
Well, thank you, Kern, for what you're doing as well, talking about this and sharing the stories is so fundamental. It's a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this interview and learned something about thinking big and why landscape approach is key to get the impact we need. If you found the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast valuable, there are a few simple ways you can use to support it. Number one, rate and review the podcast on your podcast app. That's the best way for other listeners to find the podcast, and it only takes a few seconds. Number two, share this podcast on social media or email it to your friends and colleagues. Number three, if this podcast has been of value to you and if you have the means, please join my Patreon community to help grow this platform and allow me to take it further. You can find all the details on patreon.com/regenerativeagriculture or in the description below. Thank you so much and see you at the next podcast.